Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Tech Tuesday here on All Sides. In schools and universities across the country, educators have increasingly turned to third-party companies to provide some or all of the instruction for students learning online. The rapid switch to online learning has ramped up the reliance on these virtual helpers to grade papers and proctor exams. But the potential benefits have come with some pitfalls as well. Cheating is on the rise. Artificial intelligence programs that grade papers have, varying degrees of success. Writer Monica Chin covers computers and technology in education for The Verge, and she wrote about this issue last week. Monica Chin, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, we live in a strange new world, and online learning at home, virtual classrooms, and then last spring it came on very suddenly. So school districts had very short notice to adjust. But now folks have had an entire summer to get ready for online learning and artificial intelligence. What are school districts doing right now?
From March to now, a lot of schools have had to figure out how are we going to accommodate, these either all online or hybrid programs that they've had to implement. And so one of the things that some schools are doing is outsourcing some of that work to online platforms, whether it's, fully online classes or just online tools or online proctoring. Schools have had to figure out how they're going to do this and definitely have had to come up with some solutions that they haven't tried before, as a lot of these schools, hadn't offered online classes before or not fully online programs. So it's definitely a period where we're seeing schools and districts try things that they haven't tried before online, and we're seeing those consequences firsthand.
So what are some of these companies doing? As far as administering, are they actually teaching the material, or are they just doing the sort of test monitoring and grading, grading?
There are solutions all across the spectrum. So some schools that I've spoken to are having kids take classes fully online. And one of the programs that we looked at recently was called Edgenuity. And that actually is a company where, the company Edgenuity fully does the classes. So they have their own teachers teaching the classes fully. They have, they design the curriculum. The Edgenuity teachers or the Edgenuity program grades the tests and grades the assignments. And really, it's all the whole class takes place through that program. And so the school's teacher might supplement that. Or might provide additional stuff, but really the full class is taken through Edgenuity. Mm-hmm. And then, you have varying different ones. So you have stuff like Turnitin, which, the whole doesn't run the class or anything, but is a software that can run through papers and check for plagiarism. And you have proctoring services like Examity, which is another service that I've covered in the past that also, doesn't administer the class, but they proctor the tests for you remotely. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of different tools that schools can use. I think a lot of it will depend on the needs and the budget and, just what they're looking for.
Edgenuity is a company you profile and a family you profile. They have artificial intelligence grading short answers that students take on tests. And you found interesting scenario there. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this company is a company that schools are partnering with, and as I said before, they administer the tests. They have their own teachers. They have their own curriculum. And so some of these schools we looked at really are having the kids just take the Edgenuity courses, and the grade that Edgenuity gives you is ultimately your grade that you get in the class. One of the things that this company uses is on some of the short answer questions, there's not a human grading your response. It's actually graded by an algorithm. So the way it works is it might ask you, like, you know, what was the importance of the location of Byzantium? And you put in your answer, and then you get the grade back almost instantly. Did you get full credit? Did you get half credit? It's clear that it's being graded automatically. And if you look in their, at their support forums, the way that some of these questions are graded is there are specific keywords that they're looking for. And the grade that you get is determined by the number of keywords. And so some of these questions, if it's like an all or nothing pass fail, the software just looks for, did you have one of the keywords or not? And if you had one of the keywords, you get 100%. And if you didn't, you get 0.
And you found a family, you found a mom whose son thought he answered the question well, got a poor grade instantly, and then she figured out how to game the system. As a test. She wasn't helping her son cheat. She was just illustrating how this doesn't work.
Right. And so we spoke to, it's a number of, and this isn't just limited to one school or one family, a number of students have figured out a really easy way to game the system and to get a perfect score, which is you just load your answer with as many keywords as possible. And so some of these kids are literally, they're not even writing answers. They're just they're dumping in a list of keywords. Some kids are writing their answer, then they're putting a list of keywords at the end just to make sure. Some kids I spoke to literally just copy and pasted the question into the response field because they figured, well, there must be some keywords in the question. And they were getting, they're getting perfect scores on this stuff.
Brilliant. I mean, absolutely brilliant. I don't encourage this type of behavior, but that is brilliant. It shows that we ain't there yet as far as artificial intelligence goes to grading papers. You can handle a multiple choice, A, B, C, and D, or, E, all of the, none of the above. But when it comes to grading a paper, we're not there yet.
Absolutely.
How about proctoring exams? I've heard these stories. I've never done it, but I've heard it from college students that, you have to turn your web camera on and they can see if you have looked away from your screen. They can monitor your browsing so you can't Google the answer. What's going on there as far as trying to keep tests fair?
Yeah, it's hard because when you're doing an online class, a fully online class, and you have a test, you want to make sure the students are not cheating because if they're just at home, they could easily, be Wikipediaing whatever. But some of the solutions that schools have turned to are, students aren't necessarily happy with, or not everyone is. So you have a bunch of different solutions. Proctorio is a big one. There are various levels of AI versus in-person solutions you can go with. One of the ones that I covered recently is called Examity. And the way it works is you have a live proctor who is proctoring your exam, and you basically are on a Zoom call with them and while you take your exam, and they're watching you through your webcam while you take it. And so before the test starts, you have to take your webcam, pick it up, and show them the whole room. You have to show them where your phone is. Not every school that uses Examity has this level of scrutiny, but this is that's sort of one of the extremes it can go to. It's a lot of students are creeped. I'm sure there are some students who are fine with it, but I talked to a number who are just really creeped out because it's like sitting there, taking your test and someone is sitting across the desk from you, just staring at you.
Yeah. It's hard enough taking a test when you're in a room with like say 30 people and there's a proctor up front. I mean, of course they're supposed to be watching for cheating and things like that, but one-on-one, that's what it seems like for folks, proctoring an exam. But there are stories, a Washington Post story, that a man in Qatar in the Middle East was taking exams, multiple exams for several people, and those students were getting good grades. And have companies figured out how to avoid that problem?
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of the stuff and for Edgenuity, too, there's a whole market of people who offer to take your classes for you. I think that... as long as we have online classes, which will of course existed before the pandemic and will exist after, there's going to be ways to pay people to take your test for you or ways to cheat. No matter how good the software is, I think there are always going to be people, even if it's whether it's just gaming the system, like kids at Edgenuity, or people who are actually cheating and like going out and Googling the answers. And I really think that it this sort of shows the limits of what a grading system that revolves around tests. I think it really shows what those limits are, and that I think that no matter how innovative you get with your anti-cheating protocols like Examity, they're always going to be people who figure out how to beat them, and because these people really want to cheat. And so I think at the end of the day, one professor I spoke to for the Examity article, I think, had a good point, which was she personally tries to avoid tests and just tries to figure out scenarios where students are less likely to cheat. And I think it really shows how important it is to make sure that, not all of your evaluations are based on just things that are easily Googleable or things that you're supposed to memorize, but that you're really trying to include papers and projects too, and things that can evaluate people more holistically and are less easy to game.
Yeah, oral exams would be helpful until we come up with an artificial intelligence that can turn your avatar into a real life person and they can give you the answers. It's at some point this pandemic will be over, schools will return to normal, but online learning has taken a leap forward because of this pandemic, and I think for a lot of folks, this will be more of the normal course of how students learn, how teachers teach. What are the main lessons that we've seen? You touched on it earlier that there are limits, but what do you see? How is this pandemic going to change the role of technology in education?
Yeah, I think it's so hard to say now because we have no idea how long this is going to last at the moment. We have no idea, what schools are going to keep doing. But I do think that one of the things that has come out of this whole Edgenuity debacle is really it's important to for there to be a human looking at what this, what this algorithm is doing, I think, at least, in the early stages. I really do understand, there's so much, it's such a chaotic time. Teachers and districts are really being loaded with so much that they have to do. I think it's completely understandable that you'd say, well, maybe we can have an algorithm look at these short answer questions just to get them done really quickly because they're such a small part of your grade. But I think that it's pretty clear that at least with this system in particular, the grades that students are getting on these, automatically graded short answer questions aren't really reflecting. I mean, they are reflecting some kind of learning. They're reflecting, that these students are really good at gaming an algorithm, which is an important skill.
But they're
whether the student knows math or history, what it is they're supposed to be learning. So I'd say I think definitely they show that we want to make sure that – to make sure the kids are learning what we want them to learn. We shouldn't be blindly trusting these algorithms without making sure that there's a human, keeping an eye on this stuff as well, at least for
in the near term. What advice do you have for parents who are monitoring their children's schoolwork from home, perhaps see these programs on their computers, on their phones?
Yeah, I would say, I think this clearly showed that it was worth keeping an eye on. Is that one of the things that one of the families I spoke to, the mother of one of the kids who figured out how to game the system, said, he was just really devastated beforehand when he couldn't figure out, he wasn't getting good grades on these short answer questions and he couldn't figure out why. And it wasn't until the parents took a look and sort of said, oh, this is an algorithm, here's how you game this stuff.
Oh, I tell you, I don't think he will. I'm sure that student is very smart, obviously, and the parents are pretty smart, but I'm not sure you got to put that on your college application essay. I successfully gamed the Edgenuity short answer portion of my exam when I was a sophomore in high school.
it's definitely worth, checking out what this stuff is and, making sure that, if there's something fishy, I definitely think it's worth taking a look at. And, because this stuff is new, for a lot of schools, we're figuring this stuff out for the first time. And there's so much going on that, I think we're going to run into, this isn't the last hiccup we're going to run into.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's definitely definitely worth taking a look.
And we should mention that a couple of school districts here locally, Westerville, Upper Arlington, are dropping third-party companies after concerns over content and some of the safeguards there. So school districts as well are keeping an eye on this and trying to figure this out. Thanks very much for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Monica Chin from the publication Verge. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about, the GoFundMe sites, how to give safely to what appear to be worthy causes online. That's when Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned Columbus brewery and restaurant, offering home beer delivery and curbside food pickup Tuesday through Sunday. More at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Hundreds of thousands of donors to a GoFundMe campaign called We Build the Wall learned last month that a portion of the $25 million raised may have personally enriched the organizers. Federal prosecutors in New York have charged former Trump senior advisor Steve Bannon and three others with fraud in that case. Crowdfunding sites like GoFundMe, Kickstarter, and Indiegogo are popular platforms for raising money for all kinds of causes, political causes, the pandemic, natural disasters, local charities. Americans, in turn, have responded swiftly and generously to calls for help. But consumers, donors should beware. Joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher is supervising attorney Patrick Denier. He is with the Charitable Law Section of the Ohio Attorney General's Office. He wrote a recent article for the Ohio State Bar Association titled, What You Should Know About Crowdfunding. Patrick Denier, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you.
Have these sites have been around for a while. Have they increased in number since the pandemic began?
The sites themselves, I don't know that they have increased in number. However, the campaigns within those sites have increased. So the campaign meaning, the number of individual pages that would be asking for donations for various causes.
Okay, so Kickstarter has been around, but people asking for what kind of things are they asking for? Help with the rent on a personal level? Are they asking for help with, help get health care to low income folks? What kind of things are folks asking for? These sites asking for?
That's right. It's across the spectrum. It can be an individual need, as you mentioned, rent, medical expenses. Anything and everything you can think of, and it doesn't always have to be something bad or some emergency. It can be people have started campaigns to raise money to fund an album. Musicians have done that, so there are all manner of asks out there.
Yeah, I mean, kids raising money for a trip to, people really aren't traveling right now, but you've seen them in the past. I want to go to this camp, or I want to go on this trip for my school or for my Boy Scout troop or Girl Scout troop or church group, things like that. And they often turn to Kickstarter, basically to help relatives and friends give.
That's correct.
What kind of controls do these companies have? Because we talk about, we'll get to the case of the Build the Wall thing in a moment, but there are, disreputable charities, always have been. What kind of controls do companies like Kickstarter and crowdsourcing websites, what kind of things do they have to try to prevent this from happening?
So they advertise on their respective pages that they do scrutinize these particular campaigns. So they have teams of folks that will either proactively or reactively look at and investigate pages. And of course, if they receive a complaint from an individual, they will follow up on that. So the information available on their websites, I think, tries to give the particular donor comfort that there is somebody there to look into these and ensure that they're on the up and up.
Okay, they say they're looking out. How confident are you that they are actively monitoring? Because there's hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of these efforts going on, at least. I don't know how many there would be.
Well, that's you're right, Mike. It's I think virtually impossible to proactively look into every single one of these individual campaigns. So certainly they will, I'm sure, do the best they can. But a lot of this happens probably on the reactive stage rather than proactively.
That's kind of the nature of the game when it comes to online things, whether it's purchasing something from Amazon, you give a review. Is there something similar here where I know Indiegogo apparently includes a link on every page allowing donors to report suspicious activity? That's how, I mean, it's sort of crowd control, crowdfunding, crowd monitoring.
Right. That's absolutely right. And some of these crowdfunding sites will let you give individual feedback and rating and things like that, as you mentioned, similar to Amazon reviews.
I know you can't speak to the particulars of the We Build the Wall case, because it's way out of your jurisdiction. But using it as an example, donors were told that 100% of their money was going to build the wall. Is there any way for potential donors to investigate where their money is going, how much is going to, say, administrative costs and marketing costs, and how much is actually going to the actual cause that inspired them to give?
There are some ways. It just depends on how much effort you want to put into it. So, for instance, one of the sources that you can look at is the IRS Form 990. Essentially, that is the tax return for charities. That has instances where you can look at the compensation paid to individuals and the expenses that charity says that they are incurring, as well as the level of programming, meaning programming being the actual work and purpose of the charity itself. So that's a good source. The only issue with that is that they're usually not available, usually about a year, maybe sometimes 2 years after the fact. So current information is a little harder to come by from independent sources. You certainly can contact the organization and ask for that information. They do not always have to honor that request.
Yeah, that's it.
And then you
go ahead.
Then you get into other sources, such as obviously I work for the Attorney General's office in the charitable law section. Every charity operating and asking for donations in Ohio has to register with us before they do that, before they start asking for donations. And they have to file reports, financial reports with us. So we're a good source, certainly for Ohio charities. And if I can plug the website,
no, please do.
It's charitable.ohioago.gov. And on that page, you can click on the Research Charities tab at the top, and that'll give you some information about the charities that are registered in Ohio.
Do you give them a grade, or you just provide the basic information of, how much money they bring in, how much they spend, that kind of thing?
No grades involved right now, although there are some websites out there that do that. That might be a direction we would move to in the future, but right now it's just the information that the organization files with us.
I can see how it would be difficult for a government organization, Attorney General's office, to give a charity a grade, but the private sites out there that grade charities, are they trustworthy? Are they being fair to the grades they give charities, and how much money they actually send to, say, fighting cancer or building large structures on the Mexican border?
Right. Well, that's the thing. As far as fairness, I mean, obviously, that's probably a matter of who you ask and perception. But Those third-party websites are as good as the information that is provided, but they do look at objective criteria. You know, complaints filed. Again, for instance, in Ohio, we receive complaints on a daily basis that are related to charities, and so those outside websites forming those grades will try to be objective, I think, is at least from what I can tell. The interesting thing about the We Build the Wall situation is it gives a pretty good example of how sophisticated some of these individuals and organizations can be in the way that they commit fraud, as alleged here. Obviously, as you mentioned, I don't have any inside knowledge on this particular case, but it does give a very good blueprint as to how some of these organizations launder money, make representations that all your donation will be used for its purpose, and then you peel the lid back and find out that the director is being paid millions and millions of dollars. And so it's a pretty good example of some of the unfortunate and unseemly side of you know, charitable giving.
We're talking about how to give safely online to crowdfunding sites with supervising attorney Patrick Denier from the Ohio Attorney General's office. The website he mentioned, I think I talked over it, so let's give it to you again. It's called charitable.ohio.gov. Is that correct, Patrick?
Almost. It's charitable.ohioago.
Okay.
.gov.
charitable.ohioago.gov.
That's right.
All right. We'll try to put a link to that on our Facebook page and on our website as well. You can't put every crowdfunding charity on there. Say if, you know, Joe down the street wants to raise money for his church group's trip, you're not going to have that on your website. It's the larger ones, correct?
That's correct. It's the actual charities that either have incorporated, you know, through the Secretary of State, or gone through some formalities of forming an actual organization. The riskier crowdfunding non-crowdfunding or the individuals, as you mentioned, just the guy down the street who's asking for money for whatever purpose.
Yeah,
those are the harder ones. And those are the ones, as far as the crowdfunding context, you have to be very wary of, because you really don't know who's on the other end of the internet connection.
Yeah. So, let's talk about that for a moment. What kind of things can folks do to protect themselves when looking at crowdfunding sites and giving to what look to be worthy causes?
Absolutely. And so educating yourself, trying to research as much as you can, going on just open source websites to search about an individual or organization, finding out as much as you can before you donate. And again, the Attorney General's websites, and you know, throughout the country, various Attorney General's offices have, you know, the kind of the similar function. It might not be called a charitable law section, but they have similar functions, whether it be under the consumer protection arm of the office. But the Better Business Bureau, Charity Navigator, the various Secretary of State offices, all of those are sources, and even friends and family, and, you know, in your community, you know, there's a lot of like online reviews, Yelp, if, for instance, and things that you can start to find out about an organization or an individual.
Any red flags people can look out for? Because that's a lot of work. And let's frankly, most people aren't going to do that. They see it on Facebook. Perhaps somebody they know well has shared it and you want to give to it. But any red flags in language and website URLs people should look for?
Language, I would say, you know, you have to use sort of your common sense. There are no certain buzzwords. Obviously, the more skilled individuals at scamming put together outward appearing legitimate sites. So that's the danger involved, is there's nothing necessarily outward that will tell you on its face that this is a scam.
Yeah.
It's usually the kind of the after the fact. But you know, I would certainly look at the URL itself, make sure it's spelled correctly, make sure it's, you know, go to the actual website itself, if it's GoFundMe or something like that, make sure that the one you're, you know, clicking on actually goes to GoFundMe and .com versus .something else. Yeah. You know, if you don't want to invest the time in research.
Yeah. Putting your donation on a credit card can offer some protection, correct? Because your bank or your lender they have some protection for against fraud. And if you find that you've given to a fraudulent, this is a fraudulent charity, not a charity that maybe doesn't spend the money quite the way you want.
That's correct. And in the crowdfunding sites, will provide some protection too. But if you pay by credit card, like, you know, obviously many people do, your credit card company does provide some fraud protection. So as I mentioned in the article, you do want to contact your credit card issuer and make sure that that's something that's covered. Switching to the alternative payment methods like PayPal and some of those other ones, they specifically exclude crowdfunding donations from their fraud protection. So you really do have to look at your particular payment method and whether it provides you that protection.
Yeah, and debit cards also don't provide as much protection as well, depending on the bank, I think, than the credit cards will. Donating online to Facebook, I mean, you see it all the time. Friends are running for a charity. It's real easy. You just click on the button. Your phone has your credit card information. Is that a safe way to go?
Well, it can be, but any time that you give your, you know, credit card or other payment or personal information out there online, it enters the, network, and anybody can hack into that at any one time. So it's, you know, obviously these payment sites have a vested interest in making sure that your information is secure, but, you know, unfortunately, we see stories all the time about hacking attempts, and it's constant, and breaches, data breaches that have occurred from very, very big name companies. So, you know, anytime you put your information out there, it's always subject to being taken.
Pay attention to your bills when they come in every month as well.
Right.
Something new you're seeing, a connection between charitable outreaches and gambling sites. What's going on there?
Absolutely. And since the rise of COVID, I can only attribute it to the fact that people are spending more time at home. But we have seen in the past 3 years, well before COVID, but we've seen about 80 complaints involving crowdfunding and other related online schemes. And so Facebook gambling sites seem to have really, really increased during the time of COVID. And what those are, literally someone hosts a game. I've seen a lot of spinning wheel, kind of like your Wheel of Fortune type. And you buy a slot or a chance to put your name on the board, and then the individual who's running that particular Facebook page will click a electronic button, and the wheel spins and comes up with a name. We've seen a large uptick in the number of Facebook gambling type activity since COVID.
Wow. I know I play a lot more solitaire on my phone than I used to before the pandemic, so you can see it's only natural. People are going to be gambling as well. Anyway, Patrick Denier, he's with the Charitable Law Section of the Ohio Attorney General's Office, talking to us about how we can give safely to many, many worthy causes on these crowdfunding sites online. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks, Mike. Pleasure to be here.
When we come back, Russell Hawley talks about all the new gadgets out there, new phones, new gaming consoles. That's when Tech Tuesday continues here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The Galaxy Note 20 is here, and Samsung has made some interesting decisions with one of its flagship devices. The newest Note has a plastic back and an underwhelming display, at least by 2020 standards, yet the phone has retained its premium price of $1,000. Here to tell us about that and more is Android Central's contributing editor, Russell Hawley. Russell, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thank you.
Before we talk about the Samsung phone, there are some breaking tech news. Details about the Microsoft Xbox Series S have been unveiled. What can you tell us about this latest in the Xbox series?
Yeah, so we've known for a little while now that Microsoft was going to do, kind of this grand new reveal for its consoles, and it was originally called the Xbox Series X. And these names are going to get a little silly the more that we talk about them, just a fair warning. Microsoft has before that they were planning on a less expensive version of this console, and in the past we've seen these less expensive versions come out after the more expensive versions and not usually released side by side, but it seems like this year, particularly as we're getting closer to the holiday season, both Sony with its PlayStation line and Microsoft with its Xbox line are planning to release both the more expensive and less expensive versions at the same time. The less expensive version is this new one that got announced today. It's an all-white console with a black badge on top, and it is labeled the Xbox Series S. And where normal consoles would start out at probably the $300 and $400 range, this is actually going to start at $299.
Ooh,
and
$1.
Really kind of, yeah, that dollar cheaper. What's really going to be kind of impressive about this console is it comes with Microsoft's streaming service or game access service called Xbox Game Pass. Xbox Game Pass gives someone who pays, the $15 a month subscription for it right now, access to a little over 100 games right now that you can play pretty much anytime you want. You can play them an unlimited number of times. And as long as you pay Microsoft that service, then you're able to access it. This is a particularly interesting decision for Microsoft to release this with this console because it means the way that people typically shop for consoles when it comes to the holiday season is going to be a little different this year. Having worked in the retail industry and still knowing many, many people who work in the retail industry, when people go and buy consoles for kids for Christmas, it's usually, let me get the console and one or two games or like an extra controller so a sibling can play or something like that. This is going to be a really interesting decision because there's going to be two different prices to choose from, but one of these, at least, is going to come already preloaded with more games than that kid is going to be able to play through the entirety of their Christmas break, and then some, for that kind of entry fee. There's not going to be, additional costs associated with it.
So is there a monthly fee, sort of like Netflix?
There is typically a monthly fee associated with it, but if you buy the console when it launches, you get a year of that service included with the price of the console.
Okay. And to renew it, how much would it cost?
It'd be about $15 a month, depending on the level of the service that you pay for.
So is this the way video gaming is going?
This is definitely the way that Microsoft has been going for a while. The idea of the entirety of the console itself being a service seems to be the trend, where you're not just paying for the online access, you're also paying this monthly fee for the game instead of paying the $60 that you would normally pay when a new game comes out. And this is on top of the service that Microsoft announced earlier this year called Xbox All Access. And that service allows you to pay a monthly fee for the console itself instead of buying it all up front. So it's actually feasible that by the time the holiday season comes around, parents would be able to set this up so that they have the console and the streaming service for the games for something like $25 a month, for a 2-year period to pay for the entirety of the console.
So they're taking the cell phone model there.
It's essentially the old cell phone model.
Yeah.
We actually don't do that with cell phones anymore.
That's right.
So it's essentially taking the cell phone model and putting it into the console world. And when you consider that a lot of these consoles have a release cycle of 5 to 6 years, paying for the console over 2 years makes a ton of sense for a lot of people.
If kids are getting all of these games online, what are parents going to do 10 years after they move out and all of these game discs are collecting dust in their basement? What are they going to do then?
I suspect they're probably going to go the route of Blockbuster, really, because the physical discs are not going to be as big a deal. That's actually the one big thing about this Xbox Series S console is it doesn't actually have a disc drive. This is a console that's designed entirely for digital-only players, which is something Microsoft had tried in the past and not been super successful with, but this time they're going at it with this entire digital approach. So physical discs are not going to be a huge thing for this next generation of consoles.
Oh, that's too bad. I have a baseball 1999. I think if you're interested, all those players are long retired that were playing in that game, I think. Anyway, let's get to the phones. We're talking with Russell Hawley, Android Central's contributing editor here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Samsung's latest entry into the Note series of flagship smartphones is getting some attention for some non-flagship features. What's going on here?
Yeah, so it used to be that around this time every year, Samsung would release a version of its Galaxy Note, and that was like the pinnacle of the smartphone for that year. It had all of the latest technology. It had, just kind of crammed full of features, and it had this little pen that came out of the bottom of it for people who really like to draw on the go. I have never been able to successfully draw on the go, but I have been with people who have just crafted absolute masterpieces on their phones with these things, and it makes me feel great about my stick figures. But the console, portion of this where you can play games on it and you can draw on it and things of the feature, being able to push this super far so that it's your only entertainment device for a lot of folks. But Samsung already did this a month ago with the Samsung Galaxy Note Ultra. Where it had all of these, kind of crammed in features and did all of these things and did the all singing, all dancing thing. So releasing this phone was kind of an interesting decision. The first thing that is important to point out between the Note Ultra and the Note 20 is that there's about a $300 difference. So while we look at that $1,000 price tag and go, wow, that's a lot, it's important to remember that Samsung just released a phone that was $1,300 as though it was perfectly normal. And that included, just all of the features you could possibly want. So this is designed to be, the kind of budget version of the Note line. So you want all of the, the powerful, crazy features, but you're not really into the extended price tag. This is the phone you get. The plastic backing comes in a couple of different colors that all look really nice. It still features things like wireless charging. The camera is good, but it doesn't feature the big thing from the Samsung Ultra, which is the super resolution zoom, which allows you to zoom in just impossible distances with your phone. And the display, where we usually see, pretty intense resolutions from the Note, where you can kind of stream in 4K and you can experience HDR streaming from Netflix and things like that. This is limited to 1080p at 60 hertz, which means it just doesn't feel when you go to use it like a super high-end phone, even though it has incredible hardware inside of it.
So does the average person, not the real techie, but does the average person notice that difference, especially in the video resolution?
Not when it comes to things like streaming video. A lot of folks like T-Mobile, in particular, T-Mobile customers, actually, when they stream video, it actually intentionally downgrades. A lot of people choose that feature across T-Mobile. So when it comes to streaming video on YouTube or Netflix, they're not going to notice the huge difference. Where you are likely to notice it if you have used a phone like this in the past is that frame rate limit to 60 hertz. The Samsung Galaxy Note Ultra has a bunch of features where it does it at 120 hertz. And that just means that when you go to slide apps or scroll in a web browser or something like that, it's just very, very smooth.
Yeah.
And when you put it side by side with this phone, you definitely notice that there's a difference in kind of how smooth it looks when you go to use the phone. I think that probably only applies to really super phone nerds like me. There aren't a lot of people who are going to put those two phones side by side. But it will probably become noticeable this time next year when there are more phones like the one that Apple is going to be releasing in a couple of months that will have that 120 hertz screen. It will make these other phones feel a little on the sluggish side in about a year, which is not great.
Yeah, and even average folks, they have friends and family that have new phones, and they try out their friends and family's phones,
right.
And that way,
yeah,
you'll see the difference there. Getting to the price point again, you mentioned $1,000, $1,300, $1,100 for a phone now, and we mentioned earlier that how you pay for the phones has changed over the years. Is this really what the phone should cost? I mean, you think about it, these are small computers that do everything that a laptop does in many respects. And $1,000, when you think about it, really isn't a terrible price for a very powerful computer you can fit in the palm of your hand.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. And that's the important thing here is that if you are using this as just your phone that connects to the internet occasionally so that you can, check on things, but you typically do most of your computing in a laptop, then you may not feel like you need a $1,000 phone. And that's why there are phones like the Google Pixel 4a, that's $350 that got announced last week. That's why phones like that exist, where it's for those people. But for a lot of folks out there, their phone is their first computer. And in places that are not the United States, it is often their only computer. So releasing phones like this with just all of this incredible power to it, that is the point, is for, to look at it as the computer in your life and make sure that it has features that support it, including, as Samsung has been wielding for quite a while now, a feature called a DeX, which allows you to connect it to a monitor or a television and actually have an actual desktop computer that you have on your screen for when you need like a larger web browser and things like that.
That's great.
So yes, these are very much computers that live in your pocket, and calling them phones is actually kind of a disservice these days.
Yeah, and they fall out of your pockets eventually and you drop them, so the monthly protection plan may not be a bad investment also, at least in the early days of the phone's life. We're talking with Russell Hawley here from Android Central, contributing editor on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Just a couple of minutes left here. The Razer Blade Pro 17. Razer has come out with the latest iteration of its Razer Blade Pro 17. The reviewer calls it a beast of a laptop. Why is it a beast, Russell?
This thing Razer has had a history of designing laptops that are for kind of the hardcore gamer, and making sure that it has all of the hardware in it that approaches that, but also making it look and feel like an all-black MacBook. You know, a lot of times when people see gaming laptops, there's giant hulking things with really loud fans, and then they're really just kind of silly looking with, bright keyboards and things like that. Razer has, when they released the Blade line, the whole point was for it to be just this kind of sleek thing that still had all of the power to it. And that is still very much true with this line. It is, from a power perspective, this has everything that a very expensive gaming desktop would have, including a top-of-the-line graphics card and a very nice processor that goes along with it. And with that comes some additional weight. You know, when you pick this up, it does not weigh like a MacBook weighs. It's got some heft to it, but it is a massive 17-inch display that comes in either 4K with touch capabilities or slightly lower quality with a matte if you don't like reflections, which is something I'm kind of partial to. Because I often sit outside, and having glossy screens is not great for that. But the ability that you get with this is everything you get with a high-end performance gaming machine that you would easily spend $2,000 on, which is why if you buy this directly from Razer, the pricing for this starts at about $2,400.
Cool. For the subtle gamer, not the big...
That's right. Not for the ostentatious among us. This is for someone who wants to be a little more subtle.
Yeah. Speaking of laptops, I mean, that's a big story right now. With virtual learning, kids having to get laptops, Chromebooks, things like that. Are companies adjusting to the regular laptop user, not the gamers per se, but the folks who are trying to learn from home?
I think the company that has surprised me the most in the way that it is adapted has actually been Dell. Dell started releasing very late last year Chromebooks for kind of the next generation of learners. So for people coming out of middle school and into high school or out of high school and into college and still wanting that Chrome experience. And that company has adapted really well by making sure that the pricing is great for students, but also making sure that it's the ecosystem that these younger folks were used to going all through school. It would be awkward to shift from, kind of that all Chrome ecosystem to then using Windows or then using a MacBook. So Dell has done a really good job of approaching these learners where they are, and also making sure that the pricing for parents want to be able to do this at home, can do so without just absolutely destroying your bank account.
What is the price point for these Chromebooks?
A lot of them started about $300.
For Dell, yeah.
Yeah, Dell's Chromebook started about $300. And as you grow, if you want something with a larger screen or a better keyboard or something like that, then they increase in price to about the $700 range. Mm-hmm. And even those are just really nice machines for what, if they were running Windows and had a different graphics card in them, you'd be looking at spending closer to $1,000 for them. So it's really impressive that Dell has intentionally made these different points for different kinds of students.
Yes, we're all adjusting, even computer companies adjusting to the situation we find ourselves with COVID. Gaming is on the rise, I assume, and laptop use and trying to help kids learn at home. Russell Holly, contributing editor for Android Central, thanks very much for joining us here on Tech Tuesday.
Thank you very much.
This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson on 89.7 NPR News.